Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for listening with us this I was going to say lovely Saturday, but you know what? I'd be lying to you because it's kind of snowy and chilly, and you know, we all woke up with a snowy surprise this morning, and we did not see that coming because it's springtime, but it's not acting like springtime out there, so hope everybody's staying warm. We're going to keep those weather reports coming for you and traffic and all that good stuff. All right, my friends, we've got a lot to get to today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We are going to be talking about a lot of Chinese investors coming into the U.S. market. We're going to be talking about all kind of good stuff, but to kick things off, we have a very special guest in studio with us today, and that is Mike Lenz. He is the co-founder of an app called Tip Yourself. It is a Chicago startup, so we're talking about local business here. And Tip Yourself is a Chicago-based mobile app, and it helps users reward themselves by, you know, anytime you do a good deed, you do exactly what the app says. You tip yourself. So here to talk about that is Mike Lenz. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you so much for having me.
So kind of talk us through this app and how what's the elevator pitch when you explain exactly what it does?
Sure. So the way we explain to people is that it's a mobile app for motivation, reward, and saving money. But really what we like to talk about is it's more than just an app. It's a community of just like-minded individuals that focus on positivity. It's that incremental, all that psychology around behavior change or just focusing on the small steps that lead to big outcomes. So functionally, the app allows you to transfer small dollar amounts into a secure tip jar that we hold on your behalf, and then you transfer it back. But above that, it's much more about the reasons you tip. And whether it's a dollar or $5, the money's not really important. It's about recognizing that little moment of victory and saying, hey, I made it to the gym. Or, you know, I had a tough day at the office, but I made it through it. Whatever that might be.
So it could be anything. And I love that. So, right, regular listeners, you know exactly why I love this app so much, because I love this kind of positivity narrative. I love that you can reward yourself for doing a good thing. And that's highly customizable. You can make that whatever
exactly
you want. So it could be, I made it through the day without punching a coworker. Yay me. Or
yep,
it could be, hey, I'm really trying to go to the gym or quit smoking or whatever. And every time you succeed, you can add to your tip jar.
And that's been one of the more humbling things about getting this off the ground is seeing all those people come together. And the common thread is just that positivity. And there's so many different ways people use it. And it's so much fun every day to open it up and look at the tip feed and just see people are just coming in and finding their own ways to leverage that positivity.
And
that's been really rewarding.
How did you first come up with the idea for Tip Yourself?
So the idea actually came from a conversation I was having with an old college friend of mine almost about a year ago. So my college friend Sam and I were meeting about a different topic, and I had listened to a podcast that morning and was just thinking about money as a big problem and trying to brainstorm around why that is. And our hypothesis really was that you have all this personal finance tools and education out there, and that's all very important. But we felt like that something was missing around earlier before that, around what's your relationship with money? What's your mindset about savings? And that's where the idea really came out of, is trying to shift a mindset of savings from you know, one of sacrifice and stress.
Discipline, right?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Right. You're like, oh, well, I would buy those shoes, but I'm going to sacrifice and save instead. And really, we want to shift it. So that's where it came out of. And it's really kind of grown from there as more people got involved. We have a huge percentage of our community today that doesn't really have a problem with money. You know, money's not their main reason for using Tip Yourself. They're using it because it helps them be more positive, and they use that tip jar as just their fun money, guilt-free spending money. So the original idea came out of, and it's still our core kind of focus, is around solving what we call the problem of money. Hmm. But it has grown to be much bigger than that, which is really exciting.
I like that a lot. So the money will sit in your tip jar, which does accumulate interest as you're you know, adding to it. And you can tip yourself anything from $1 to $250 per tip, per event. And then you will just transfer that back when you want it. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yeah. The only clarify, the tip jars don't earn interest. So we are positioning them as, you know, very similar to like we all used to have our change jar, our tip jar, mm-hmm, on our desk. And that's why we want our users to think about it. You know, if you're looking to save much larger funds or you're saving for retirement, you know, other things like that, that's not what a tip jar is for. And you're able to transfer money out of it at any time. So maybe you're saving over the month, and then you transfer it to a interest-bearing savings account.
And how long, once you initiate that transfer, I think that's kind of the issue with a lot of like financial apps and financial services. If you say, okay, I want my money, how long do you have to wait to get it?
Right now, it is much slower than we would like. So right now, it takes about 3 business days each time to transfer in and transfer out. So it's absolutely a place where we're looking to speed that up quite a bit, because you're 100% correct. When people are like, hey, I want to spend my tip jar on something, they're like, I want it now, right? It's that immediacy.
But it could be a good thing, because sometimes you're like, I want my money right now, and I'm going to put it all on red and go for it, right? And maybe you don't want to do that. Maybe
it's absolutely
maybe you want that cooling off period, right?
Yep.
So do you have a sense right now of, it seems like this has quickly blown up, just in the last couple of weeks. Do you have a sense of how many users you have right now and how much has been tipped thus far?
Sure. So, you know, this week, Apple named us a best new app, and that has been a very humbling experience this week, right? So our users have grown tremendously in the last 7 days, but the average user tips about twice a week, and they're tipping on average around $5, and we've had tens of thousands of dollars tipped already, and we've only been up and running for 9 weeks. So
that's great.
People are really rallying around the idea, and they're really connecting with it, and you know, like I said, it's humbling and exciting all at the same time.
Do you have a sense of why most people are tipping when they do tip?
You know, health and fitness is our biggest reason. You know, probably makes up about 40% of the tips we're seeing so far. And anything from, you know, diet or exercise or just active is definitely the biggest reason. And then the second biggest would be around saving money. So I skipped Starbucks or, you know, I was going to have that impulse purchase and I didn't.
I know someone who I'm going to tell about this app, but what she does is, you know, at the bottom of your receipt, it'll say you saved X amount. She'll transfer that to savings.
Excellent.
So that's a good use, right? You could just transfer that into your tip jar.
And that's where we have that utilitarian element of the app, where someone might already have a system where like, you know, I do this or I do that, I save this or I skip that. And they just want to recognize that savings decision. If it's still in your checking account, you can kind of lose track of small decisions, but they do add up. And so the tip jar, even though you are really just moving money from your left pocket to your right pocket, it all is still your money. But there is something motivating about seeing it grow and saying, hey, this month I saved X amount of dollars, and be able to really see that.
And if you look in the app, you have kind of a little dashboard every user has where it says, this is how much you've saved total, this is the, or how much is in your tip jar, and it kind of shows you lots of little interesting things, like how much to date, but how much this month or this week or whatever.
Exactly.
That it's kind of interesting to way you can kind of watch your own financial habits in that way.
And I think it's part of the product that we really have a lot to enhance and grow is around that. For people that have a specific objective or a habit they're trying to build, giving them the tools that allow them to track against that. Maybe your saving is a vacation fund. We have a lot of users like, that's my vacation fund. And, you know, they probably have a set dollar amount they're trying to get to. And so we want to be able to give them some of that positive feedback of how you're, you know, going along your journey.
And so what's next? Now you've had this, you know, wonderful start in the last 9 weeks. You probably just got to catch your breath a little bit.
Yes, exactly.
Take your own vacation fund.
Took the words out of my mouth. That's the first step is...
just kind of catch up. And catch I'm sure up. You have millions of emails in your inbox right now. But, you know, are there features coming that we should be looking for, things like that down the road?
Yeah, I think the main area we plan to expand the product is around the community and how people can interact. Right now, there's one tip feed. Everybody's in it. And so that, you know, goes by pretty quickly. So if you either have friends or family or other people tipping for similar reasons, we want to make sure that you can find that kind of subcommittee within the larger Tip Yourself committee. So if you are around health and fitness, you're going to find more value in seeing tips from other people doing that same thing. So that is definitely where we're growing from, trying to expand kind of what we call tip feeds and allowing either, you know, friends and family, so more of a permanent connection, or maybe temporary. You just want to open up like, hey, who else is, you know, saving money at the bottom of their receipt, you know, and so allowing those kind of subcultures to connect.
Sure. Do you think there's a point at which we will be able to tip others on the community?
It's probably one of our top requested features, and I think it's exciting to explore that, especially tipping other people or tipping charities or tipping for a cause. And that's what's very exciting about just the concept. It's a very simple and easy to understand concept, but it applies to so many areas, and it applies in a positive way. So the future is just really exciting. And like I said, we're you know, looking forward to it.
Great. Well, people can definitely follow you on Twitter. You're at Tip Yourself on Twitter. But where else can people go to find more? You're in the app stores. You're everywhere.
Absolutely. So right now we're only for iPhone. We will definitely be expanding to Android as soon as possible. So to all of our Android brothers and sisters out there, we're not forgetting you. We promise. And so you can find us at tipyourself.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to just get your thoughts around what you like, what you don't like. If any other feature requests, you know, we're still very young company, very young community. And so the more feedback we get, the better we're going to be going forward.
Excellent. All right. So everybody head to tipyourself.com and I'll be sure and tweet that link out myself. And so thanks so much, Mike Lenz, co-founder of Tip Yourself, for joining us today. And we will, I suppose, see all of you in the Tip Yourself community.
Absolutely.
In
Tip
there
Yourself.
Filling our tip jars. All right. We'll be right back in just a bit on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks so much for being with us today. I normally say this fine Saturday, but I'm not sure if you would all agree with me given the weather. I see everybody put those parkas away, and then we all had to get them back out this morning. But that's all right, my friends. Hold tight. Spring is coming. I know it. It's got to eventually. All right. You know what? Next up here on the Business Lunch, we are talking with Elizabeth Fournier, and she wrote recently at Bloomberg about all these Chinese investors that are making really sizable and interesting investments in the U.S. market this year in particular, and they're grouped around some really interesting categories. So here to talk us through that, Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, how are you? Well, so I read with great interest your piece at Bloomberg.com. Everyone should head over and read that. It's called 8 Things Chinese Money is Buying in America Right Now. And you group it into these categories. And it's very interesting. And I think we think about technology a lot. We think about the Chinese technology market. We think about manufacturing. But there's some very specific subgroups of all that that you picked up on. So talk us through that a bit.
That's right. Well, it's been a very interesting 3 months since the start of the year. Chinese companies in general have been spending a lot of money on buying things overseas. That's not just here in the US. So they've spent about $100 billion around the world. To put that into context, that's almost as much as they spent in the whole of 2015. And we're only 3 months into this year. Now, about $40 billion of that has been here in the US. So it's a buying spree.
I have to ask why right now? Why this sudden spree so early in the year with such a high dollar amount?
It's a good question. There's no single easy answer. One reason is the economy. The growth at home, growth in China, is slowing a bit. The companies are naturally looking a bit further afield to find new customers, new know-how, new products. And the government's definitely encouraging that. Mm-hmm. They're helping out by providing money for deals. They're making statements encouraging them. These companies have got money to spend, and they want to find somewhere to spend it.
Fair enough. Okay, so take us through these categories a bit.
Right, so there's no sort of one place where they're looking. We've seen deals in real estate. We've seen sort of luxury hotel deals. Big names, you know, Four Seasons, Intercontinental, Westins, places where everyone's stayed. So some companies are looking at hotels. Others, home goods. So GE Appliances was a company earlier this year that got bought by a Chinese buyer. They make things like refrigerators, dishwashers. So that sort of exposes China to the U.S. consumer. That money's coming in. But aside from that, we've also seen filmmakers. So the Hollywood producer, the company that made The Dark Knight, Godzilla, that was bought by a Chinese company, as was Grindr, the dating app. So they're really diversifying in their targets. It's not the traditional sort of commodities, technologies, companies that maybe we've expected to have Chinese bidders for in the past.
And what's notable about that, the dating app, it was the same group that brought Angry Birds to China. So we're not talking about a small group. We're talking about someone who's used to scale and who can, you know, handle a significant amount of volume like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that's changed. The Chinese business world has traditionally been seen as kind of opaque. And suddenly you've got all this money, these big companies coming out, and they're making these sort of these landmark acquisitions. And companies have to be comfortable with that happening. The company they're buying needs to know that the management can come in and they can run the company. They're not going to shift out the management and move the headquarters. The board's got to be comfortable with that.
Right, which is always, I think, a tense moment in any company. Just, you know, big, significant change like that, I think, really, you know, sometimes can bring out a lot of bad behavior in employees and executives because everyone kind of feels like they're struggling for, you know, to keep what's theirs and all of that. So that's always an interesting time, just kind of culturally in a company, certainly. And so what do we think we're, do we feel like this trend, surely not, but possibly, will continue the rest of the year quite this high? Or do we think it's going to sharply drop off or a gentle taper?
Well, things could get pretty interesting. Just this past week, a couple of Chinese companies have pulled out of big deals, and they were in a situation where they had the highest bid. It's kind of hard to read what's going on, and people are asking a lot of questions about this, but it could signal that the enthusiasm is waning for these big overseas deals, and it could also make the U.S. companies that they want to buy a little bit more wary about getting into negotiations. On the other hand, it could just be a blip. I mean, these companies have money to spend, and they need to find growth. So as long as they're getting the right target in the right place, I don't see any reason for it to fall off dramatically.
And so you mentioned that just the U.S. is only, you know, partially you know, seeing this huge, huge spending amount. So where else, what other country, what would be second behind U.S.?
Well, actually, it's Europe where they've spent the most amount of money, and that's pretty much because of one big deal, which almost, I would say, kicked off this trend this year. It was a big agricultural chemicals deal, which doesn't sound like the most exciting thing in the world, but there was a company in China called ChemChina, and it bought a Swiss agricultural company called Syngenta. That alone was worth $40 billion.
So,
and that was just...
Go ahead.
And that was sort of the first time this year when everyone really sat up and listened and went, okay, this is happening. Chinese buyers are coming, and they're serious.
Yeah, yeah, that's no small dollar amount there. That's quite serious business. All right, well, thanks so much for joining us and breaking all this down for us. Everybody, head to Bloomberg.com. You want to see 8 things Chinese money is buying in America right now. That is the story. It is by Elizabeth Fournier. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. All right, my friends, let's take a little break and get you to news. And when we come back, more of this fun here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us today on this very snowy, surprisingly snowy Saturday afternoon. Hope you are bundled up and cozied up somewhere and with your radio or laptop or app or however you listen to us. We appreciate you. All right. Plenty more to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A little bit later, we are going to be talking about student loan debt. I know that is a big topic and a lot of people have very passionate feelings on that, but we're going to be talking about that because Crane's Chicago has done a really interesting special report. So we're going to be talking all about that. But you know what? Right now joining us on the program is Catherine Ho, who wrote about why the small business lobby in Washington is opposing Merrick Garland's nomination for the Supreme Court. And you can find her story on WashingtonPost.com. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Thanks so much for being with us today. Well, so talk us through this because, you know, it seems like most of the narrative around Merrick Garland is neutral to positive, but there is a little bit, okay, a lot of bit of, you know, politicians that have very, very strong feelings. So it seems like the voter, you know, the public narrative has been one way and the political and the politicians' narratives have been a little more impassioned about Merrick Garland. But this is all really centered around the National Federation of Independent Businesses. So kind of talk us through this and exactly what it is they're opposing about Merrick Garland.
Sure. So the NFIB is the small business lobby in Washington. They represent the interests of small businesses all over America. And a lot of people don't know this, but a few years ago when the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act, which a lot of folks know as Obamacare, the lead plaintiff in that case challenging that law was actually the NFIB. And they, of course, lost that case. And when they did, it was, you know, disappointment, but they also felt like, in a way, it was really a big step for them. It was a milestone because, you know, this is the high court in the land, and they had brought their issue all the way up there. So, you know, when they lost that, they knew that they really had to play in the legal space and not just lobbying space. So when you know, Justice Scalia died unexpectedly, you know, they kind of viewed it as their first chance to really shape what the Supreme Court looks like, and what the replacement for Justice Scalia will be. And this is interesting because you haven't heard a lot from the business community and business groups about Merrick Garland. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the big groups have largely stayed out of it or, you know, said no comment. So the NFIB so far is really the only, at least that I'm aware of, the only business group in Washington that has come up and said, yes, we oppose him. And, you know, the reasons why are mostly that he has sided with regulatory agencies before. He's had a long career on the appeals court, and in many cases he has sided with federal agencies. And, you know, right now the NFIB says that a lot of these agencies are imposing regulations on small businesses that really hurt small business owners. So they see Merrick Garland as kind of a threat or someone who's going to be bad for small business.
And so the NFIB is a plaintiff in three cases that they are viewing particularly key here as they talk about their reasons for not supporting Garland. Take us through those generally.
Sure. So two of the cases involve environmental regulations that the EPA have put out. And those cases are kind of in various points in the courts right now, but the NFIB feels that at some point the Supreme Court is going to be the final word on those cases. And in both of the EPA cases, they feel like the regulations are going to be very damaging, very expensive, and very burdensome for small businesses. And the third case is a labor union case. And they feel in that one, if the Supreme Court, you know, does weigh on it, they, I think, are nervous that it will go on the side of unions instead of business.
Mm-hmm. So they announced their opposition to Garland in a recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal and really breaking it down and stating their position as to kind of what their issue was. And they also plan to launch a social media campaign to continue to oppose him and to, I believe they're planning something like a scorecard that's, if it's not out yet, it's about to be, of kind of exactly breaking down what their issue is with him.
That's right. So you've seen a lot of political conservative groups opposing Merrick Garland in kind of various rallies across the country and including on social media. So NFIB is kind of joining that chorus. And I think if you take a look at their Twitter account, they're expressing a lot of concerns about Merrick Garland's record and what they view as decisions in favor of government agencies.
And where does the NFIB usually fall? It seems like they're fairly nonpartisan, but it seems like they will, at least from the outside looking in, it seems like they kind of will stay, more right-leaning for a couple of, for some period of time and then go a bit left and then kind of bounce between the two a little bit. But what, I mean, is there, looking through their history, do they, you know, seem to be favored by one party more than the other?
I think, like most business groups, it's fair to say that they're probably a little bit more on the right side of this, you know, the political spectrum. They're not nearly, I don't think, as conservative as some of the conservative, you know, groups that are now kind of the leading voices opposing Garland. But I do think, you know, in general, business groups, including the NFIB, tend to be a little bit more Republican-minded, mm-hmm. Just based on, you know, they don't like regulations, they don't like, you know, new rules that they feel the Obama administration has imposed on businesses.
Right. It is really interesting because as we look at things like the groups behind Small Business Saturday and local, municipal organizations pulling small businesses together, they tend to be a lot more left. And I agree, the NFIB does seem to have a bit more right-leaning track record. So it is interesting. It would be interesting to identify exactly where that split starts to be, at what point when you break down small businesses that are grouping together. Very interesting stuff.
Right.
Well, everybody, head to WashingtonPost.com and read the story. It's written by Catherine Ho. It's called Why the Small Business Lobby is Fighting Merrick Garland's Nomination. And there's a lot of really good information there because you do such a great job of breaking it all down for us. So thanks so much for joining us and shedding a little more light on this really interesting topic.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks so much and have a great Saturday. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking all about student debt. I know it's a big deal. I know it probably just made you cringe when I said that. But it's a big thing and it affects so many, many, many millions of people. And Cranes Chicago did a really interesting special report on it recently. And we're going to talk all about that. So stick around. We'll be right back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. As the snow kicks up, I just saw a bunch of people walking by the studio here on Michigan Avenue all kind of put their hoods up all of a sudden because I know we all put those parkas away, but we had to get them all back out this morning. But indeed, the hoods are going up. That wind is kicking up. We're going to keep you updated on the weather and the traffic as a result all afternoon long, of course. All right, my friends, still plenty more to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. There was a really interesting special report just recently at chicagobusiness.com, and it was all about college debt. It's all about that student debt, and I know a bunch of you just groaned because it's very pervasive. Lots of people are really, really feeling the pinch of those student loan payments. And so here to talk about that is Stephen Strahler from CraneChicagoBusiness.com. Hello, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Amy. How are you?
Wonderful. Thanks for being with us today. So talk us through this. This is a really interesting report that you guys have put together over at Cranes. And there's so much really interesting and some of it surprising information. But kind of talk us through, the big takeaways for you and things that were very eye-opening as you started this report.
Well, to put it into perspective, the total accumulated amount of student debt right now is just over $1.33 trillion. Which is more than auto debt or credit card debt. The total of those two categories is about $2 trillion. And it's really ramped up in the last decade, coincident with the Great Recession that has caused a lot of people just coming out of school not to be able to find jobs that help them pay off the debt. We have a few examples in the story of people who have six-figure student debt balances.
The story opens with an example of someone who is paying, I think it was $1,200 a month just to put this student loan balance down. And that's most people cannot do that. That's a significant amount of money. And you were even talking in her case, she's talking about postponing having more children. She's not going out. She's not doing much, but paying on that student loan.
Right. She and her husband are paying essentially two mortgages. The student debt payment, $1,200 a month, equals what they pay on their mortgage. Mm. And they would have liked to have gotten a bigger mortgage with a bigger house. But they weren't able to do that because they didn't qualify for one, given the student debt burdens that she has.
It's really significant. And so you say it's gotten worse in the last decade. I think that's something everybody knows, but there's a lot of anecdotal information around why that is.
So, well, one of the principal reasons is the growth of for-profit colleges. A recent Brookings Study Institution last year pinpointed that as a major source of the increase in student debt. And I have an example in a separate story in the section of mid-career people who have decided to go back to school to get a degree in hopes of improving their job situation, their income, and so forth, and they go to maybe a for-profit school. And as I show in one example, the guy gets out, he applies to the Chicago Police Department, passes the exam, but then is notified that he's not qualified because his degree that he got isn't accredited.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that happening a lot. And so when we're talking about for-profit, we're talking about, I think some of the bigger, like University of Phoenix and some of the ones that
here in Chicago would be DeVry, Career Education. There's a company called Institute of ITT, mm-hmm. which has a campus here, a couple of campuses here.
And usually that those educational opportunities are marketed to people in the, hey, improve your situation quickly, affordably, and there's usually in as little as this amount of time, you can have this certification or this degree. And it's about kind of a quick advancement in your career generally is kind of the narrative around those, I feel like.
Right. And people who graduate from college with a lot of student debt in many cases go on to graduate school and just pile up more debt under the assumption that, okay, I'm going to be taking on more debt, but I'll have a better degree, I'll get a better paying job. And as we've seen in the last few years with the economy, that just hasn't happened in many cases.
Right. There's so many unemployed or underemployed college graduates, and some, as you point out, with quite advanced degrees. So what is next? I feel like we're so at this breaking point. If people are essentially paying two mortgages, people have got to be just completely fed up and stretched to the max. So what can be done, and what
are
people doing?
There are projections that student debt balance is going to hit $2 trillion by 2020 and maybe double by 2025. So we haven't seen the end of it by any means. But one would hope that as we go along and see more coverage of this, that students today are going to be forewarned about the consequences. I do think The other trend that's been a negative here has been obviously the rapid increase in tuition at all schools, particularly public institutions that, as we've seen particularly in Illinois, that are losing state support. So their tuition is going up, and kids have just had to shell out more money. So I think we're probably going to see a moderating of tuition increases over the next few years, so that could help.
Are we seeing more young people just saying, you know what, forget it, I'm not going to go, it's not worth the debt?
I have no comprehensive evidence of that, but I assume in many cases that's true. If they see kids, older siblings or others who have gone to college and are just back on the family couch, I'm sure they'll have second thoughts about it.
And it'll be interesting to see kind of how that that group mind and habit is, and that thinking around this is passed on, because I think, as Gen Xers, I'm a Gen Xer, and I think a lot of us got out of college before this got really, really bad. And so, as Gen Xers have kids that are starting to look at colleges, I think it'll be interesting to see kind of their attitude, what got passed down. And then as millennials start, as their children start moving into colleges, when maybe mom and dad are still paying on student debt, it'll be interesting to see how that kind of starts shaking out.
Yeah, you have situations already, I think, where you have couples who are paying off their own student debt and now their kids' student debt.
That's almost impossible for most households, I got to think. Well, so there was an interesting thing, though, in here that caught my eye, too, that there are some surprising advantages, and I think we never hear about that, we never think about that, of having some student loans.
Well, it teaches, it's maybe quick therapy in teaching you to be more responsible financially. I did cite a Northwestern graduate student's research that shows that for every $1,000 of student debt someone has, they tend to have a job that pays $400 to $800 more a year. So, that's an incentive. If you have a lot of student debt, you're going to be more aggressive in the job market, maybe skip that unpaid internship. Another advantage is if you do have student debt and you are current on your payments, it establishes you as a good credit risk. So you can go out and get, in many cases, you can get a mortgage, if you can afford it, like the example that we talked about earlier, the woman, she's got two mortgage-sized payments, but she was able to get a loan because she had established that she was paying
That she was credit worthy because she was on it, right. And so meanwhile, there's entrepreneurs that seem like they're kind of capitalizing on this and marketing products or developing products directly to people who are really just swimming in the student debt. Tell us about that.
Right. There's people like there's a company here called Peanut Butter, another one called Gratify that approach companies with 401k-like programs, employee benefit programs, that help the students pay off their student debt. So if you were applying to a certain company, PricewaterhouseCoopers, the big accounting firm, is one, you can sign up for a program where you will get $1,000 a year to help you pay off your student debt.
Which is significant. If you've got a lot of student debt, that's got to be a very attractive benefit for an employer to offer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's resonating according to the companies who are providing the service. When you're a millennial or when you're just starting out, the thought of putting away money for retirement isn't necessarily top of mind.
Well, sure.
And they say these kind of benefits are preferred even to like gym memberships and free food and other sorts of goodies like that.
Right. All the new ways to define golden handcuffs, indeed. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Everybody, head over to Crane's Chicago and check this out because there's a lot of really, really wonderful information in this report. It's really fascinating. Stephen Stroller, thanks so much for being with us today.
All righty. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and then turn things over to King John here in just a bit on 720 WGN.